You're listening to the Tumbling Saber Podcast, a member of the Star Wars Commonwealth Podcast Network. Check us out on the web at starwarscommonwealth.com, on iTunes, Facebook, and Twitter, and take your first step into a larger world. Everybody, and welcome back to Journals of the Willing, a very special edition of the episode today, where we're going to get it all out, get our feelings out there about our beloved princess, our General Leia Organa, as Carrie Fisher tragically passed away at the age of 60 just a few days ago, and it compounded by the loss of her mom, Debbie Reynolds, which happened just mere hours ago here as we record on Wednesday night. So we'll talk about that. We're going to also recap Bloodline, which seems oddly fitting. That was on our docket for this week. And here to help me do that and get some catharsis done, James, how you doing, buddy?
Doing all right, Kyle. To, you know, not the greatest of terms to be recording an episode to come and have to talk about the untimely death of one of our heroines. But here we are, and I'm hoping to have... Like you said earlier, an even show where we try to keep things, from going all the way somber, because it's been a pretty sad day or two for all of us.
Yes, indeed. And also with us, regular here on Journals of the Willing, it's Mr. Steve. How you doing, buddy?
Hey, good. Definitely a somber mood this week, but you know, happy to be here as always, and just happy to talk Star Wars and the impact that Carrie Fisher has had on us all.
Absolutely. And I mean, let's back this way up till Christmas Eve, when for myself, I was out starting and finishing my Christmas shopping after work on Friday, after my bout with whatever it was that I had that sidelined me for a few days. And I got a notification on my phone. I think it was from James, maybe from Corey, that Leia, or Carrie Fisher, had a massive heart attack. So I stopped what I was doing, sat down on a bench in the mall, and sure enough, I saw the headlines all over the place. Carrie Fisher rushed to the hospital after getting off a flight, or she collapsed during the flight and was then rushed to hospital. And you know, right away, your heart sinks, you know. There were obviously no details, and it was a pretty sketchy report. But you just got that sense that this was a big, bad deal. And Steve, where were you when you first heard the news?
I can't quite remember where I was when I had heard about the heart attack. I remember when I found out that she passed, I was actually going between appointments at work. And I was actually in the car, and I kind of peered over at the screen because I heard it buzz. And I think it was from one of you guys. I saw a notification, and I kind of just had to pull over that moment just to kind of read through it and collect my thoughts. But as far as Christmas Eve, I mean, it was all wrapped up in kind of the hullabaloo of just getting to and from family. So I must have been at either my fiance's family's house or our home when I first found out, you know, about the heart attack. But just the moment of finding out about her passing, that, you know, that really stands out to me.
For sure. James, I think I heard it from you, but I guess you were at home prepping for the holidays.
Yeah, we were getting things ready. I did fire off that bad news, unfortunately. I was at home getting ready. My wife, Em, used to be a flight attendant, and she pointed out basically her heart attack happened in the worst possible place on a plane. There's like that golden hour after a heart attack where, you know, the quicker you can get care, the better your chances of coming out, you know, healthy are. And she, you know, she's as far away from help as she can be. Even if there's doctors on the plane, there's, you know, there's only, they're so limited in what they have in terms of tools and supplies. So, she just, it's really unlucky, you know, so young and in such a unfortunate place timing wise to have that heart attack on Christmas Eve.
Yeah. No kidding. Christmas Eve, the holidays are, you know, are right there knocking on the door, and you're on a plane flying home, presumably to your family and friends. And to have that happen, man, just what a punch in the face. I mean, we as fans are definitely suffering through this, but my thoughts, and I'm sure all of our thoughts, definitely go out to her daughter, Billie Lord, who just must be in agony right now.
Terrible. Awful.
I can't even imagine, really.
Yeah, you're not supposed to bury your kids. I you know, Debbie Reynolds. I know it was a stroke, and I'm not a doctor, so obviously when they perform the autopsy, if it's a stroke caused by a blood clot, then you know it's not related to her daughter at all. But I'm gonna go out and say on a limb here, and it doesn't really make a difference, but I'm gonna say it's gonna be a stress related you know, issue for sure, an aneurysm of some sort that led to that. Because boy, man, she must have just had a broken heart.
Well, yeah, just days and days of being on edge and worrying about your daughter and,
yeah, the stress. And,
you know, she was elderly herself, you know, maybe she wasn't eating and or getting her proper rest. And at that age, it doesn't take much to, you know, send yourself into some sort of incident with your heart. And it's not a very big stretch to progress that to a stroke and a fatal one, which apparently Debbie Reynolds did suffer. So a real cruel double whammy to their family and fans across the globe.
Yeah.
So yesterday, it was around lunchtime yesterday, 1 p.m. our time in the Eastern time zone. And the news hit me sort of twice at the same time, where I just started seeing those first headlines on Twitter. And I was like, whoa, I had to read it three or four times. And then almost simultaneously, I got like messages started rolling in from people who were also hearing it and saying, have you heard? Did you hear? And it's like, oh my God. And it almost had that feeling as if like one of your own family members died. It was just that hard of a blow.
Yeah. Well, I think you put your finger on something there. The fan base that grew up with the original cast, like, you know, there's no more core member of the Star Wars cast than Princess Leia. And, you know, the fan base is so devoted to loving the cast and crew and characters and story that it feels sort of like a big family. So when you lose, like, everybody's, you know, sister, it feels worse than sort of some other celebrity deaths, because we're just so, this fandom, the ones, the people we're talking to right now, and you know, yourself and Corey and everybody else who's super fans or whatever you want to call them, it does feel like family for sure.
Yeah, and you know, I think with regards to Carrie Fisher, you know, of course we've grown up with her, along with the rest of the cast. But I think it says something that, you know, she was the baby of that cast. She was the youngest person in A New Hope. She was probably, again, the youngest in The Empire Strikes Back, unless some random peon soldier was younger. But she, as far as speaking roles, roles that matter, prominent, she was, again, the youngest. Sure, yeah. And that carried through until Return of the Jedi, unless you want to talk Warwick Davis, who was literally a child. And she, yeah, 60 years old. She was so young then, still young now. And there's no There's no cast member that fandom has rallied around and rooted for more than Carrie Fisher, to, you know, despite her messy personal life and her struggles with addiction and this and that. Fans really were emotionally invested in her. So, Steve, I don't know. Does it get any worse than Carrie Fisher? I mean, I can't imagine what we saw, the outpouring that we've seen for Carrie Fisher, is any worse if it's Mark Hamill or Harrison Ford or even George Lucas himself. Like, this is as bad as it gets, no?
I mean, I feel like it would be hard no matter who it was. And it'll be hard in the future when we inevitably lose another. But, I think just Carrie, like you said, the fans really stood by her. Like you said, through like the addiction and her personal life, people really did root for her. There was an investment in the fan base for her. People grew up with her for decades. People felt this connection. She's made such a strong impact on so many people, even just outside of Star Wars. I was reading a lot of posts that my friends were putting up on like Facebook and Twitter, and they were really recalling Carrie Fisher, an advocate for mental health issues, because she was so candid and open about her own struggles that she really spoke to people, even just outside the fan base. She spoke to people on a really strong personal level. So in that way, I think it does touch, especially hard for a lot of people in that way.
Yeah, I think you touched on something important there about Carrie Fisher, is that being the huge celebrity that she was, in portraying one of the most iconic heroes of all time, but as a person, she wore the same, or she had the same vulnerabilities and weaknesses that any of us have, and she wore them very proudly. And she spoke openly about it, like you said, and really owned them in a way that a lot of people only aspire to. And I think that makes her loss all the more tragic, because there's not many people like her.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, she always seemed really genuine. She always came across as super genuine in interviews or excuse me, I was watching a bunch of stuff this last couple of days, like everybody else. Did you guys catch that interview she did in French?
No.
I just watched that today.
YouTube that, Kyle. Really good. And it's interesting too, because it's really, she's very young. It's when the first Star Wars movie came out. I guess it's late 77 or maybe it's 78. And the guy is speaking completely in Parisian French, and she's handling it all like a champ. Her spoken French is a bit nervous, but she obviously understands everything very well and speaks pretty well too. But the line of questioning was really interesting too, because one of the questions he asks her is, are you worried that you'll be typecast after playing this space princess? Which I thought was sort of maybe a question wise beyond its time.
Yeah, no, I wasn't. And she was doing this interview in French?
Yeah, Harrison Ford sitting beside her, looking like he probably doesn't understand, and it's the whole interview. I think it's French television. It's all.
I actually had no idea that she could speak a word of French.
Yeah, pretty solid.
Wow. Well, there we go.
She says it. She says at one point, she says, the movie's C'est pour le monde de 6 ans à 60 et 20. Je veux dire 79. Excusez, je suis nerveux.
Wow.
Yeah, she's really good.
Okay, good for her. I mean, I had no clue. Just another. Part of her skill set.
Lots of feathers in that cap.
Yeah, I mean, she was so talented. I mean, beyond the iconic role, and like, she had a prolific career, even if you take out the whole Princess Leia bit. I mean, as a writer, as a screen doctor, like Steven said, a mental health advocate. Like, she just did so much. I mean, a short life, but a life pretty well lived, I would say.
Yeah, I saw a quote attributed to her. I hope it's her. Because, this, unfortunately, it's with social media, you never know how much of this stuff is sort of made up on the spot. But it sounds like something she would say, and I'm going to paraphrase, but it basically said, you know, stay nervous, but take chances anyways. You don't have to be confident, you know, to do the things you want to do, and eventually the confidence will come. And I believe that's how she lived her life. Like, it seems like that as a 19-year-old in that first Star Wars movie, she was probably doing all kinds of things she couldn't believe she was doing.
For sure, yeah. I mean, look at some of the names in that movie. Alec Guinness, although she never had any scenes with him. Peter Cushing, who she had to go toe-to-toe with. And then there's this menacing guy in black armor that she has to talk down to. And she basically gaslights him, which is now funny after seeing Rogue One.
Yeah.
giving it to Harrison Ford. George Lucas said it in his sort of memorial to her that the role of Princess Leia was certainly much more difficult than anybody really imagines it to be.
Yeah, I think that's true. Especially at that time. It'd be easier to play Princess Leia today. But women are taken just so much more seriously than 1977 and 83.
I imagine she was a teenager,
yeah,
and she pulled that off.
Yeah.
Yeah, she says she didn't even realize she was paving the way for future heroines. She was just kind of doing it. And she was like, all right, I'm doing this now, and I'm going to be Princess Leia.
The more you think about that role and the how groundbreaking it really was, and really as it served as a blueprint for so many heroines that we've seen since then, it just kind of blows the mind that she just did it with. It looked like she made it look easy, and I'm sure it was anything but.
She was made for that role, so much so I had to bring an anagram to the show, and so Carrie Fisher anagrams to Hairs Fiercer. So Carrie Fisher Hairs Fiercer. And I think that's as close as I could get to, like, I wanted something. I wanted the anagram to say something that was like impactful and made her sound strong. And that was some fierce hair. No one's hair is fiercer. Not my anagram, by the way. I got to give credit to Zach Sherwin for that one.
You know, speaking of that hair, I didn't realize how long it took them to get that hair together. I'm listening to her audiobook now. And she said hair and makeup, that hair alone took them 2 hours before every shoot.
You got to have some kind of patience.
Yeah. Well, back then, that was probably like unheard of. You have more of that today with these, you know, Pirates of the Caribbean and Lord of the Rings and 8 hours in makeup. But I don't think they had a lot of that in 77, 83.
No, Star Wars was ahead of its time in a lot of stuff.
Man. Looked heavy too.
Speaking, yeah. Well, it's not Amidala headgear heavy, but I'm sure it. I'm sure it wasn't very comfortable. Did you guys see the American Film Institute video during from the George Lucas roast?
Sorry.
It's funny.
I must have. It was. Yeah. How long ago did they do the roast?
I'm not sure what year it's from. But Carrie Fisher's part was 4 or 5 minutes long. And it is an absolute riot. I had never seen it before until I think yesterday I watched it, and it's outrageously funny. And she looks absolutely hammered. Looks like she's having the time of her life, and she just tears into this routine, and it's hilarious.
I'll have to go back and check.
Yeah, I will after the show for sure.
It's well worth the 4.5 minutes, however long it takes. I was hoping for another few minutes, because at this point, I just want to go and watch all the videos with her in it. It's kind of one weird way to kind of feel like we've kept her here, but yeah, it sometimes it takes a really terrible incident like this to make us appreciate the person that was.
Yeah. If you want a good chuckle, there's a really funny Carrie Fisher moment from last year when she was doing promo for The Force Awakens. She did an interview with Gary, her dog, I think with ABC, it was, I forgot, one of the morning shows here. But it was ABC, and it was just like Gary was falling asleep in the middle of it. But just the way she's just so comfortable, talking about just the gamut of everything. It was just hysterical. It was, it's only like 4 or 5 minutes, but I definitely recommend going on YouTube after this and checking that out.
Yeah, for sure. I can't get enough of her, especially right now. And, you know, we're sort of longing for
it's more of it her. It still doesn't feel real, does it?
No. And she's too young.
And I don't know. I don't know at what point it will sink in. But yeah, at this point, the day after her death, it does not. It doesn't feel like it's really happening.
Well, and I've been thinking about sort of the impact of this on the movies, and we saw Rogue One with a ton of other people in that sort of little window where her cameo at the end wasn't. You know, posthumous, or, you know, she was still with us to say, like, well, it sort of looked like her and they can use her. But now anybody who sees that effect, and now everyone who goes to episode 8 next year, it's sort of a different, you know, feel when you see that scene, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. It's like you're looking at somebody from beyond.
Both of the CGI scenes will feel more similar now. The Peter Cushing scene felt a little different because, you know, we don't have Peter Cushing. Well,
and we haven't had him for 22 years.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, that last moment now is really going to take on a different feel.
A lot different, I think. Yeah.
And she, I think I read an article. She finished all of her scenes for episode 8. Am I right? Did I read that right?
Yes, you did. Yeah. So everything is locked in the can for episode 8, and I guess they won't do any changes to her for that movie. But and I we'll get into this again in a later episode down the line. But yeah, I guess any changes obviously will be reflected in episode 9, which I'm sure is going to be a pain in the ass unto itself.
Yeah.
You know, a thought came to me yesterday, or maybe it was early this morning, that once we start seeing trailers and footage for episode 8, it's going to be real tough. We're going to relive this again if we see her Leia, which I imagine they'll cut her into any trailer. But it's going to be tough to look at, to see her face, to see her character on screen, knowing it's going to be the last movie where we get to look at her.
Do you think they'll shy away from using her as much in like the early promotion? Because of this, do you think they'll try to like be more respectful in that sense, or I don't know? What are your feelings on that?
I don't think they'll go heavy on her. I don't think. I think she'll just feature very lightly in the trailer, and that'll be that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's no getting around it. It's going to be, you know, Carrie Fisher's absence from the press junkets and the early promo for the movie, that's going to be a talking point. So I think they're going to have to address it. I don't think they can just pretend that, you know, she's not around. She's really is not around. But I think they're gonna have to acknowledge that.
Oh yeah, it makes more sense that they would.
I mean, I don't think they have to harp on it and remind everybody, but I think to acknowledge it and as sort of a sign of respect, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
I think that would be probably appropriate. So, guys, any favorite Leia moments that you want to put out there?
Yeah, they're all favorites, but that hologram, and it's not just because it's a Leia moment, but that hologram scene when I was a kid was really, like, really stuck in my mind because I always like the idea of the hologram technology from that scene. So not just the fact that, you know, the repeated image of her sort of punching over to feed R2 the information, but the idea that image could be seen from a 360 degree, and that in my mind one day I'd have a TV in my living room that was like a 360 degree angle that I could watch a movie from the front and the back, like that scene is quite iconic to me, and I spent a lot of time in my mind.
Absolutely, and more so lately with that scene tying directly into Rogue One.
Yeah, right, for sure.
And you're right. Like, it's the one of the first images of Leia we've got in our minds. Her kind of hunched over in that transparent blue,
looking over her shoulder, and sort of, you know, a quick desperate peek, and then you're my only hope. I don't want to shy away from it. Like, that bikini scene is completely and, you know, utterly part of my teenagehood.
It is. I mean, there's no getting around it. There was a reason why it was made and why it was heavily marketed upon for so long and why it's so indelible now. And now it's sort of a taboo thing to talk about that costume, and specifically because of how she, Carrie Fisher herself, didn't like it.
She hated like it. So I always hate bringing it up, but like, and I don't want to be disrespectful at all. That's not my intention. But if we're going to bring up like the scenes from Star Wars that were iconic to me in my youth, that Carrie Fisher bikini scene, Alyssa Milano posters from teen magazines, they go hand in hand. They were part of the things that I had plastered on my wall. So it's
absolutely. You know, and you know what, that, I suppose like we'll talk about this later when we recap Bloodline, but Claudia Gray did one of the coolest things ever regarding that costume. And it's kind of referenced a little bit in Bloodline. And there's this character, I forget, his name escapes me. Steve maybe can remind me.
Was it Rin Riven?
Yes. Yes. So he's got this little box that has the holographic message in it. And it's basically footage of Leia strangling Jabba the Hutt. And unbeknownst to Leia, her reputation had grown sort of in the underworld, and she had been given the nickname of Hutt Slayer.
Nice.
Which I think is a really, really great way of retconning, in a way, something that Carrie Fisher really didn't like, and giving it a totally empowering twist.
Yeah, I do like that. I'm glad to know that.
I mean, despite kind of the taboo nature of, you know, the bikini and, you know, kind of the sexist undertones now that people, you know, take from it, you know, there kind of is in it, like you said, they kind of retconned it. They created a reputation within the galaxy for that moment in killing Jabba. And I was going to use that moment as probably one of my favorite Leia moments, was Leia taking down Jabba. Because, I mean, there is a bit of a feminist aspect to it in the sense that, you know, she was a character being objectified and then using those chains to take down her captor. So you kind of, if you kind of read the text like that, it embodies kind of the strong female protagonist that she was. You know, and I mean, as coming as from a gay man's perspective, you know, I'm not personally objectifying Leia on that end, but I see it kind of as a strong female fighting back. That's kind of what I took from it. And I'm a sucker for strong female characters. So I kind of take that moment. And I try to put the positive spin on it.
Oh, I love that take for sure, Steve. That's, you know, what we all loved about Leia wasn't the fact that she was pretty, because there's lots and lots and lots, and the list is really endless of pretty actresses in Hollywood. But we liked Leia because she was more than just pretty, although she was very pretty. She was just so cool and strong. Like the scene where she's nodding, you know, the silent nod she gives everybody right before they get their medals. You know, Han's got that like swagger, and Luke looks bashful, and she just has this like sort of all-knowing, like, omnipotent sort of grin. You know, I just love the way she looks in that scene.
There, yeah, there's a wisdom and presence about her, even as a teenager, that I'm kind of playing to the home team here, but I can't think of somebody else so young. And let's not forget, I mean, she was a really small person too. What was she like? Maybe 5'2", 5'3", all of 100 pounds at that point.
Tiny, tiny,
tiny person, a really tiny person. And yet she physically, she stands in there.
No,
and
she had
because of the way she holds herself. Like, she looked regal. You know, I'll never forget seeing her for the first time in those white robes on the Tantive IV. She just looked so ethereal. There was just something, the poise of her, the natural beauty of her. There was, she was just staggering in every aspect.
No, she had a wisdom beyond her years, especially on screen, especially in that movie. Omniscience, mm-hmm. I think I said omnipotence, but omniscience. She seemed to know more than she should.
Yeah, she certainly. Yeah, that was, it was. That's something definitely about not only the character, and I'm sure that came across as. You know, when she was going through the process of auditioning and getting to know some of the filmmakers, I'm sure they recognized that there was an innate wisdom about somebody so young.
It probably came from growing up around show business so much. She probably just had like a comfort level, maybe around that scene more than most.
Yeah, that too. So, okay, so continuing with some of our favorite Leia moments. James, I think, did you take a turn?
I threw a couple ideas in there.
Steve?
Well, yeah, like I was saying earlier, I think her taking down Jabba was probably my number one. I feel like there's so many. Like James said, just the classic image of her in the hologram. And I think just kind of, in general, seeing her growth, this might be a bit of a cop-out, but I feel like just seeing her growth from princess to general, you know, I loved seeing her in her role in The Force Awakens, because we got to see her from the beginning of the franchise to now where we are now, her taking charge. And I think that growth encompasses that strength and that wisdom that we were saying that permeates the screen.
Yeah, for sure. I think one of my favorite moments comes from Empire. And it's during their escape from Cloud City. And they're running from stormtroopers and they're returning fire. But there's a moment where... you know, they're shooting back, and Leia, it almost seems like she's reluctant to run. Like, she's so mad that she just wants to stand her ground and just kill every last stormtrooper. And she would, too, if Leia didn't tell her to get on board. She just keeps standing there, almost like a hobby, picking off stormtroopers one after another. And I just love that resolve, that tenacity, that fire about her, that, you know, as much as she could, you know, be the politician and the stateswoman, she could also roll up her sleeves and kick a bunch of ass too, which she did throughout the entire trilogy.
Definitely.
And yeah, I mean, there are so many other moments too. And like seeing her in The Force Awakens, I had never thought that we would see her in that role when we knew that she'd be coming back as Leia. I think it's safe to assume we all kind of assumed she'd be back as quote-unquote Princess Leia, or would she be Queen Leia now? I think we were probably all thrown for a little bit of a loop when we learned that she'd be going by the name of General Leia, or General Organa. And that was a truly amazing moment, because you said, holy shit, like, that sounds like somebody who's just sitting on top of the mountain now. She's the boss. I had a chance to see her earlier this year. She had her own gala at Just for Laughs, and I did not go. And I was just so cavalier about it. I'm like, nah, I'm not going to go. Like, I don't like going into the city after work. It's a huge pain in the ass. I'll see her again sometime. And boy, imagine the regret now that I didn't even think twice about going. It was just like, nah. And apparently that gal of hers was really something else too. She was really funny, and it was all her own material that night. I think that would have been something really special, especially, you know, it being a 2016 thing. And there really wasn't much racetrack left ahead of her. So there's definitely some regret there on my end.
Yeah, no kidding. That sucks. I wish I would have gone too.
And I remember a couple years ago, she was supposed to be here for Montreal Comic Con. And this was right before the announcement of Disney taking over. Actually, I can't remember if Disney had already taken over. But nevertheless, she was supposed to be here. And in the last days, or maybe a week before the con, she bailed out. And, okay. I mean, celebrities bail out of conventions all the time. Sometimes it's because they've got other engagements, more pressing work that comes up, and they've got to go. And in this case, we all just assumed that, she's got to get to work on The Force Awakens, and that's okay with me. I can live with not seeing Leia in person if it means I'll see her on screen soon enough. But again, it was another case of I'll see her again at some point, and that point now is the opportunities are gone, I guess is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah.
I mean, I think, you know, they've been a part of our lives, all of our lives, the fan base, for so long that they felt like a constant, right? So there was always those, oh, there'll be another chance, right? Which is, I think, something that you've been touching on.
Yeah, yeah. You just kind of, you take it for granted that there will always be another time. But at some point, there is no more time. And sometimes no more time comes very, very quickly, as we've just learned. So I don't know. Is there anything else we want to get off our chests here regarding our dearly departed princess?
Yeah, what else can you say? There's all the tributes. There's some great pictures of her from, you know, meeting Nixon. There's a great shot of her today I saw. The early cast stuff from Star Wars. It's sort of fun to just reminisce and go through the life of someone that we all have been in love with. Like I'll call that my first leading lady that I ever loved. I think I said that to you in a text today. On screen, that was the first time I ever was starstruck and in love with a movie star. It was Princess Leia.
100%. She was, for the longest time, really the only one that mattered. All right. Well, I guess that will be it for now. I'm sure we're going to talk about Leia some more as time goes on here. More thoughts will come into our head that we'll need to get out. All right. So James, thank you, sir, for coming on board.
Yeah, guys, have fun with the journals of the whilling.
Will do, and we'll chat again soon.
All right, guys, peace.
All right, take care, James.
All right, so before we move on to Bloodline, just want to mention that there's a few charities that Carrie Fisher was involved with, and if you're so inclined to part with a few dollars, some of the charities that she was involved with, either directly or as a donor. And this list coming from uprocks.com, the Alzheimer's Association, the Make-A-Wish Foundation, the Midnight Mission, which offers food, shelter, reintegration training, clothing to down on their luck people, the Humanist Hub, not to be confused with the Human Fund. I think Fisher was honored with the Lifetime Achievement Award there, and the International Bipolar Foundation. No secret that she was a sufferer of bipolar disorder, and that was the purpose for her service dog Gary, to kind of keep her in check. And there's five charities there that if you want to make donations in her name, I'll put a list in the show notes on the blog, and you feel free to part with a few bucks and support some of those causes that were near and dear to Carrie Fisher's heart. And from there, we can now get into Bloodline. We'll do a quick recap and breakdown of that book, which seems oddly appropriate considering the circumstances. So, Steve, when did you read this book? I hope you read this more recently than I have.
I finished it, I want to say last week, if not the week before it. This was my first book delving into audio. So this was actually my first audiobook I finished from beginning to end. And I have to say, the Star Wars books, since then I've listened to, I've done Bloodline, Aftermath, Ahsoka, so far, and now I'm on the second Aftermath, all in audiobook. And that the production on those, it's fantastic.
Yeah, it's just not a narrator, right? There's music and there's effects, if I'm not mistaken.
It feels like an audio drama. Yeah, there's music, effects. The narrators that they get, really, they do a phenomenal job. They're not just narrating. They're acting the hell out of these books. I forgot the narrator for this one. I should have written it down. But just fantastic. They could do so many voices. You really feel like they're just different characters. So they really, it was a woman, I think, that narrated this one. I could probably pull it up. She did a fantastic job. I'm just going audible quick. I want to make sure I give her some credit.
You make a good point, though, because I think a lot of people, and especially older people like me, who are much more comfortable with paper at this point still, you know, audiobooks do have something extra to offer, especially when you get a good narrator who, like you said, treats it more like an audio drama, and you get that post-production stuff of music and sound effects added to it. It's really almost like watching the movie.
Exactly. It was January Lavoie was the narrator for Bloodline. Oh, and she was fantastic. Yeah, you really feel like you're listening to a film. You know, and it's a totally different experience. And like you said, like nowadays, at least for me with work, I'm always in the car. I'm very pressed for time. So it kind of, it helps weave the books that I want to get to almost seamlessly into my everyday routine. You know, and if there's just something I need to take note, maybe I'll stop for a moment and I'll jot down some notes so I remember. But otherwise, I feel like I've had a pretty good job at kind of retaining the detail, and it's so vibrant that it kind of stays with you anyway.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the details kind of as I was prepping for this portion of the show, which I always assume that I have more time than I do, especially, you know, it's tricky at this time of year because you, the holidays, and you think you're going to be home from work, and you'll have time to sit down with your thoughts and your notepad and take some notes. But no, at least not in my case. I've had very little time to do anything on my own this holiday season. And I also remembered that my dear younger brother, Corey, who took months and months to read Bloodline, still actually has my copy of Bloodline.
Oh, Corey.
So I was unable to reference the notes that I had made for myself in that book. So I jotted down some stuff here, basically from memory. So we'll see how this goes. I may lean on you a little bit here to
nope,
fill in some
no
blanks.
Problem.
This book, I mean, essentially, I don't know how many listeners are still not up to speed with this book, or at least the major plot points. But it's set 6 years before the events of The Force Awakens. And it really fleshes out some of the key political dividing lines in the galaxy and ends with Leia forming the what we now know as the Resistance.
Yeah, and it's interesting. You know, you bring up the politics, and that's something that really stood out to me because I feel like, at least as far as the fan base is concerned, there's a... a 50-50 feeling on Star Wars and politics. I feel like a lot of the, so you hear with like the prequels, a lot of the fans who may not be fans of the prequels, you know, they note that they weren't too fans of the politics in it. And I almost wonder if it's a negative association just because the politics were in the prequels. They didn't like the prequels, so therefore they didn't like the politics. Because I absolutely love that aspect in this novel. And the politics were definitely present in both. Well, there was a little bit in Catalyst and Tarkin. So you kind of get into these novels where, you know, you delve into that. And I noticed, you know, if you remember in The Force Awakens, I think there were some Senate scenes that were taken out.
Yes.
Either for time, or maybe they felt fans wouldn't respond well to them. I'm not sure. So I don't know, but I liked seeing where the galaxy was. And it really does help set the stage for The Force Awakens. Did you do you think there was a missed opportunity? Did you want to see some of this in The Force Awakens? Or, you know, what was your takeaway?
I would have liked to have seen a little more politics. I understand why they didn't do that. At least I think I do. You know, The Force Awakens moves at a blistering pace, and I think that's by design. And I think political scenes, you know, if they're well written and well thought out, they really do add a lot to the movie. But I think in this case, it would have slowed the movie down a little bit, and maybe been out of line with the tone that they had set. But I did miss the politics in The Force Awakens, and I'm one of those people along with you that I appreciate at least the political angle that we got in much of the prequels. I think a little bit was ham-fistedly executed and sometimes poorly written. But you know, you've got a 2-hour movie to make, or to get from A to B. And so things just have to happen. Like, it always struck me as weird how they would just talk about a vote and, oh, the vote's going to happen right now. And suddenly, oh, and there's the outcome of that vote. And it seems to have taken place within a 15-minute span. Where, you know,
right.
Politics just don't move that quickly. But in those three movies, they did.
We get a little bit of that in the book. I forget where exactly, but there are instances where a senator can call to motion something, and they'll have a vote in that moment. I forget where it was exactly. It might have been something Lady Carice said, or the vote for first senator, obviously, that was going to take a while, because obviously they needed candidates and whatnot. But I vaguely remember it moving a little quickly, at least on certain decisions. I think maybe with the the mission to Bastatha, I think that was brought to a vote, if I'm not mistaken. Am I right in that?
I believe you are right in that.
Yeah, so I think, you know, decisions like that can move quickly. So I guess that's just how they're, you know, like, unlike U.S. politics or Canadian politics, I'm sure there's similarities there. You know, we have, you know, the bill goes up and has to pass one branch of government, goes up to another, yada yada, it takes forever. Here it seems to kind of move a lot quicker.
Yeah, and I understand why some people would might get frustrated with that, but overall, it's more about, you know, getting the thing done and having the consequence play itself out, right?
Right. I mean, they can't make you have to make one story. You can't make it would be very boring, I think, storytelling to have a film that follows like a bill become a law, you know? You'd have to, like, a series. Like, I feel like it has to move quickly, you know?
Yeah. You don't want to fill in, you know, the month between the vote and the motion to delay the vote. Like, what is this about? Like, let's just get this thing moving.
Exactly. So they have to, you know, just a suspension of disbelief, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, I mean, back to your original point. I understand why politics were avoided in The Force Awakens, but I'm glad that we do have these books like Bloodline, like Tarkin, like Catalyst that do give us those doses where we need them. Because I feel like it's fans like us that, you know, the fans that just dive into everything that's thrown at them. I think it's people like us that want those angles. I think people who key in more on the movies, and power to them. This is not a knock by any stretch. They want the Star Wars comfort food of movie stuff, which doesn't always constitute politics.
Correct me if I'm wrong. I'm not 100% sure. So the aide that went to Hosnian Prime in The Force Awakens, was she the aide in this book?
Yes, Corsella.
That was Corsella.
Correct.
Okay. All right. I thought so. All right. You know what? I completely forgot that character's name because obviously she was cut from the story. But yeah. Okay.
Yeah, she that was makes in one, much clear. One only in one shot in The Force Awakens, and that was it.
Her scene was she was supposed to go before the Senate and kind of plead with them to help out with the First Order.
So Leia was supposed to appear in The Force Awakens far sooner when she sits with Corsella and says, "I need you to go to the Senate. Do I need you to go address the Senate and tell them that they need to take action against the First Order?" Mm. Something to that effect. And that scene was ultimately cut from The Force Awakens. I think it's a deleted scene on the DVD release.
I maybe the new one. I don't think it was on the initial release. I don't remember it being there.
No, maybe not. I remember being very underwhelmed with the deleted scenes that we did get.
Right, right. My one last point with The Force Awakens, like politics aside, do you feel like having that Senate scene would add a little more emotional weight to the destruction of Hosnian Prime?
Oh, for sure. Yeah, I mean, Hosnian Prime was destroyed with as little attachment as Alderaan.
Yeah.
One of my few problems with A New Hope is that, okay, fine. They blew up Alderaan. Why do I care?
Well, Rogue One gave us that now.
Yeah, we care a little bit more now. And, you know, they kind of, Bloodline helped us backfill some of that information because Leia deals with a lot of her grief in Bloodline regarding Alderaan. So they've kind of retconned how we feel about Alderaan's destruction now. But at the time, and, you know, for years, they would blow up this planet. And every time I'd be like, okay. Because even Leia herself in the movie, because it moves so quickly, because George Lucas moves his movies along so fast, she doesn't even mourn.
Right, she doesn't have time to grieve, really.
No, I mean, she's too busy consoling Luke because he lost his mentor who he knew for, you know, 24 hours. Whereas she just lost her entire world, including her parents. Which is another testament to the Leia character.
Yeah. Did you get a chance to read the Princess Leia miniseries?
Yes. I was super stoked for that.
Yeah. I'm glad. I mean, that too kind of gave her a chance. Because that took place after A New Hope, right? It was like between 4 and 5?
Yes.
I want to say.
It seems like everything is set between 4 and 5.
They're playing with that timeline a lot. I mean, the main series is set there. I mean, I'm hoping eventually they'll jump to a different, you know, my hope, my, you know, is that they'd eventually go post Return of the Jedi, but we'll see what happens. I don't know how many arcs they can do within that timeline still. Are you up to date at all? I know we're kind of jumping away from Bloodline a little bit.
No, that's fine.
Are you?
I've read Princess Leia. As far as the comics go, I'm mostly up to date. I've bailed out of a couple of titles just from time. I just wasn't reading them. I'll hope to get them in trade at some point.
That helps. If you have it, you know, if you could like binge read through a trade, it's much easier than waiting kind of the week to week.
Month to month in some cases.
Oh, yeah.
And it's cheaper too.
That's another thing. I don't know how much more my wallet can take of this, my pull list at the comic store.
Yeah, mine has dwindled and dwindled, unfortunately.
I almost feel guilty though, leaving the store. I feel like I've built a nice rapport with the owner. So, I know, part of me almost that I get a little, I feel a little guilty. I should.
I totally understand. Totally understand. My pull list used to be 15, 16 titles a month, and I slowly chopped that down to now where it's 3.
Mm.
And it, I can easily reduce it to 1. It's right now the Star Wars title, and otherwise I have Old Man Logan, and I have Trinity over on the DC side, and I could easily cut those Old Man Logan and Trinity and not feel like I've missed much.
I didn't realize Old Man Logan was it's an ongoing?
Yep.
Oh, I thought it was a miniseries.
I thought it would be too, but no, we're at issue 15 or so now.
Oh, wow.
Yep.
Oh, cool.
All right, little tangent there, but back to Bloodline.
Yeah.
So this book kind of shattered some beliefs that we had, that fandom had, about how the post-Jedi world unfolded, i.e. that Ben turned to the dark side as a teenager and then took Rey and dumped her on Jakku as a 5-year-old and then kind of bolted with Snoke. I think we all kind of ran with that assumption as a collective fandom. But then here comes Bloodline and we get into it and whoa, what? No, there's no mention of Rey at all. It's made clear that that Ben is still with Luke. And we're just a few years before The Force Awakens. So, wow. Okay, let's throw everything we thought we knew about the timeline here out the window.
Right. I mean, I'm trying to remember exactly everything they said about what Luke was up to. But I'm pretty sure that Luke was with Ben. And I think Leia said specifically looking for Jedi secrets and researching the Jedi. Did he have his school going at this time?
I believe so. Yeah, I believe at this point he still had his thing going. And she makes reference that, she doesn't hear much from Luke anymore and nor Ben for that matter. And Han is off doing his starship racing.
Leia's feeling isolated here. And you get a sense of that right off the jump here. Like I want to say right off the bat, she's contemplating leaving the Senate. She wants to get back to her life with Han. Because I think she said she only sees him like 6 standard months out of a standard year.
Yeah. And that's, that like you just said, that makes this whole thing so much more tragic in that she was ready to call it quits and just retire and enjoy her life with Han. And then the whole thing unravels and we come to the point where we are now where Han Solo is dead.
Yeah. You could see why their relationship was going where it was to the point where they were separated in The Force Awakens. I can't imagine not seeing my fiance for 6 months out of the year. I feel like that would put a serious strain on any relationship.
Yeah, for sure. Absolutely it would. It's clear that they're looking forward to getting away together and leaving all this intergalactic intrigue behind. And then once Leia is sort of pushed forward as the populist candidate for first senator, and she realizes that duty calls and she can't turn this down, at least not right now, you kind of know that Han is just like, ugh. I know you're not going to say no, so you do what you got to do, and we'll just put it off for a few more years.
I mean, not only does Leia have that sense of responsibility to the Senate, I mean, she's still, you can kind of tell that she still longs for adventure at this point, too. Even after all those years of peace, there's still something that draws her to a mission.
Yeah, that fire was still burning. the adventure, excitement, Jedi craves not these things, but the Skywalkers do. it's just in them.
Yeah. Do you want to kind of go plot, like plot point by plot point, or how do you kind of want to
I think I think just we'll keep it simple and we'll get right to the meat and potatoes of the book that that I think most people would like to know. And so I think the big turning point of the book, so the plot device that the whole story hinges on is the eventual reveal through a series of people and events that the galaxy doesn't know, outside of Han, Luke, and maybe Chewie. Leia mentions how she's not sure if he knows. But that Darth Vader is her father, her biological father. Nobody knows. Also Mon Mothma may know, but it's certainly far from common knowledge. And then very suddenly her friend in the book, Ransom Castorfoe, decides that he's going to blow her secret. He comes to learn her secret through Lady Carice.
Lady Carice, yeah.
Yeah, so she... if we really want to unpack this whole thing, we might be here all night, but really quickly, Lady Carice was named... what title was she given of that world? Beren, was the world that she became?
Was Beren. Yeah. I didn't write it down, but I'm trying to see if I can gaze my eyes on it.
Anyway, it was a prestigious title of this planet of Beren that Leia was supposed to assume. And Leia kind of turned it down and said, well, Lady Carice, you know what? I'll give the honor to you. And as part of accepting that honor, Lady Carice was, I guess, by oath, forbidden from revealing any of the secrets that she would learn or have access to. But the one secret that she did stumble upon, and she really did stumble upon it, was opening up this music box that Bail Organa had gifted Leia. And within it contained a message from Bail to Leia saying... that her father was Anakin Skywalker, the Jedi who became Darth Vader. And that secret, you know, Lady Carice had her own thing going with the early fledgling First Order. And she decided to use that information to her advantage. And so she fed that to Ransom Castorfoe, who had become... Even though they sit on opposite sides of the political aisle, they'd become good friends and had come to trust one another despite their political differences. And fast forward to that midpoint of the book where Ransom decides to inform the entire Senate and the galaxy that, oh, by the way, Leia, she can't be trusted. Her dad's Darth Vader, and she conveniently forgot to tell us all. And that was just, I remember reading that part of the book and just my heart was pounding.
Oh, I mean, me too, because I think that was something we were all kind of wondering as fans. Like, we didn't know how far that information had gone. Even in The Force Awakens, we really had no idea who knew and who didn't. They never really addressed that in the movies. It was always just something that we knew that the main cast knew. But as far as their reputation goes within the galaxy, we had no idea. And it certainly came as a betrayal, you know, 'cause I think at that point as a reader, you know, even though Ransom was at the opposite end of the political spectrum, you know, we really grew to trust him and, you know, and all, you know, kind of see past all his quirks.
He was a guy that at first you hate him 'cause he seemed like a sniveling jerk. And then he comes around and you start to see that the guy actually isn't that much of a loser. But then when he blows Leia out of the water, he's not doing it so much out of spite or anger. He's doing it because he believes it's his duty to inform people of the truth.
Which is interesting, because they note in the book that there is actually a law explicitly stated that the, I guess the Senate had written it some time ago, that people are not to be punished for the sins of their fathers or mothers. So it's just interesting, you know, when you look at Leia's character, you know, I was trying to think how the best way to put it. I guess the theme of it was her kind of mourning Alderaan and separating herself from Vader, and her, I guess, her fears of, you know, how the world would see her.
Yeah, and you know, she kind of sat on this information forever, right? And she alludes to it, I think it's more than once, where she wanted to tell Ben, but she just could never find the right place or right time to sit him down or to pen that letter to explain it all to him. Now, if Corey were here, he'd be screaming, saying, both her and Luke should have manned up and told the entire galaxy that, look, this is who we are, this is who our father was, and this is what happened on the Death Star, and that's just how it is. Except it's I think it's made pretty clear in Bloodline that the galaxy still feared Darth Vader. And so hitching yourself to his name would have been the equivalent of political suicide. At least that's the right way I interpreted it.
No, and right, and you see it like in a perfect world, I think being open, you know, in a perfect world that would work. But, I mean, as you see kind of at the end of the novel, you know, her political career is over. You know, she has to step down from the election. And she's really no longer a senator of influence. You know, even though she does have some people in her wing, you know, it'll never be the same.
Yeah, her political capital was completely ruined because of that reveal. And it makes you wonder. I mean, had she been honest from the beginning, you know, for sure she would have lost that political capital, but could she have rebuilt it over time? Whereas she lost it anyway. And she's at the, I guess, at the age, at the point of her life where she wasn't going to be able to rebuild it. So should she have been honest from the get-go anyway? It's really hard to say. But yeah, that was definitely the biggest turning point of the book. And from there on in, we quickly start to learn about, we come to see the Leia that we eventually get in The Force Awakens.
Right. You know, I think you bring up a good point. Like, if she was honest from the get-go, you know, would she then be able to, at this point, gain the Senate's trust to address the First Order at this point? Because we do get a strong sense at how stubborn the Senate is and how narrow-minded they are in their thinking. I mean, it's kind of actually very funny how Claudia Gray, I think she parallels, you know, our own politics. You know, in the U.S., we have our dual party system. And, you know, people would say there's a lot of gridlock. We can't really get a lot done because emotions are very high and no one's really willing to reach across the aisle and compromise and make a decision. And that seems very true here in Star Wars.
Yeah, it seems like politicians, whether in Star Wars or in our own world, and I think Claudia Gray, like you said, did a great job of this, that being on the other side of the aisle, if you can leverage something against your opponent, you'll use it. Whether it's dirty or sleazy to do so, you're going to do it. So it's understandable why or how Leia didn't want to come forward with the truth, because she knew she'd be scuttled for it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. She knew that they'd use it against her, for sure. But I loved the way they weaved the birth of the First Order in this. How the plot, you know, the missions that she was going on with Ransom, you know, the plot that she unraveled with Lady Carice and Arlys Hydrasian. It's interesting to see how the First Order was built from within. And now reading, or with audiobook, I should say, listening to Aftermath, you can kind of also see the very beginnings of it, you know, and you can kind of see how the remnants of the Empire collided with the inner workings of the Force Awakens era Senate, and how that got built. They really are kind of bridging the gaps with these novels.
Yeah, you know, that's the part of the book that I struggled with. I had a lot of trouble following who was financing who and how the First Order was coming to be. Like, what constituted the First Order? Were they a thing unto themselves? There's that faction of the Amaxian warriors. Were they part of the early First Order?
Yeah, you're right. I mean, it was a little tough to follow, but you know what I took away that from it was, you know, you had people in the centrist group who favored stronger military presence, favored stronger government action. You know, you had the corrupt members of that party interacting with kind of the seedy underground. You know, you had Arlys Hydrasian, you had Rin Riven Dai. I mean, I don't know how explicit they got exactly with the funding. You know, you just got a sense that they were, you know, helping each other out, really.
Yeah, I mean, I think I got the main takeaway in that you're right. Some of these the centrist senators that were loyal to the Empire and who wanted to see something like the Empire be in charge of the galaxy. So yeah, they were like funneling money to these organizations. I think Rin Riven's organization was sort of the front for all of this, through, you know, the billions and billions of credits that went through them and trickled down to wherever else they needed to go in order to build up the First Order. But yeah, it was really fascinating to see, you know, I think it was Greer and was it Joff or Greer and Greer and Ransom, I think, going to, was it which planet did they go to? But anyway, Greer takes off on a little scouting mission on her own, and she finds like just battalions of starfighters. I don't know.
Was it Sebensko, maybe? Or
yeah, maybe it was.
Try it. There was Bastatha, Sibensko, Daxum 4.
Maybe it was.
It was Daxum 4, where they meet up with Hydrasian. Then Ransom gets the Imperial helmet, the Royal Guard helmet.
Yep.
And that's where they see the Amaxines.
Yeah. So it's probably worth reading this book again for me to make it all clear, or find a good video on YouTube to clear it all up for me. but it's certainly really cool to see these. I mean, the First Order is really at that point. We're just 6 years out from The Force Awakens. They're almost a finished product at that point. It's probably too late for the Senate to do anything, even if they wanted to at that point. It's now just a matter of the First Order biding its time.
Right. I love that scene, kind of that final battle with Princess Leia and Han, kind of just taking down that... I guess they had a fleet, right? On that last planet.
That water planet.
The water planet. Sibenska. You know, you kind of... You know, it's tough because, like you said, like we know where they end up in The Force Awakens, but that last moment, you had like a moment of hope for Leia and Han. You know, they had like this big finish together. You know, and you just assume that they would kind of, you know, fly off into hyperspace.
Yeah, you're kind of hoping for them to do that. No, go with them. Just take off, guys. Leave. But yeah, alas, you know where it goes. Han goes back to finish his race. Leia returns to the Senate to sort of unveil her findings from her investigations. And I forget, they don't ask her back, do they?
No.
No, so she just sort of takes her leave. She's, I'm out. Here's what I found. Have fun with this issue. I'm going to just leave. And I guess what she does is then gather up a few of her trusted allies and friends and says, you know what, guys, there's a fight coming and we're going to need to be there to protect the galaxy. So what do you say, you, me, and these other people here, we set up shop as the resistance?
Yeah, and kind of the final push in that direction was, they had the assassination of Tylan Garr, I guess her close senator colleague. And that was kind of, and they had pinned it on Ransom for Lady Carice. And I thought that was a great Princess Leia moment, kind of right before she starts the resistance, where she turns Lady Carice in for revealing that information. And she's stripped of her title. It was kind of that last gotcha moment that she could have before leaving.
Yeah, you know what? I feel like Lady Carice, we need to know more about her. I feel like she was really the one that set this whole chain of events into motion. And she's there and then she's gone. And we may not ever see her again. But I feel like we probably should. I mean, she's played her role in this book, and, mm-hmm. and there's no need now to see her. But man, what a big role she had.
Yeah, I think not getting a lot from her added to the plot twist that she was part of the First Order, because we're led to believe that she's kind of like this uppity. You know, she's part of the Elder Houses. You know, she's very self-involved. You know, kind of not ditzy, but you know, I imagine almost like an heiress, you know, very like Paris Hilton type in a way.
Yeah. Just full of herself, and just yeah. Like, very vain and needs power to validate her existence.
So it was definitely, I feel like a good plot twist that there was much more sinister aspect to her. So I think now, having read Bloodline, maybe we could go back and learn more about her, but I definitely think it served Bloodline well to kind of have that little veil of mystery.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know?
Yeah, I mean,
I love that we got a, oh, go ahead.
No, go right ahead.
No, I mean, I love that we got a little bit of Ackbar. You know, we got shout outs to Mon Mothma. We found out kind of what happened to her post Return of the Jedi, because I don't think we really knew what her place was. And I think she was Chancellor for a while.
Yeah. It's funny how we're kind of getting novels at all points in the timeline here. So, you know, we're dealing right now with the Aftermath trilogy, where Mon Mothma does feature. And then we jump ahead, 25 years later, to Bloodline, and Mon Mothma is out, and almost, I don't think she's dead, but I think it's mentioned that she was seriously ill and just sort of faded away. Is that correct?
I'm not quite sure if they I don't know if they stated whether she was dead or alive at this point. That might be my mistake. Was it revealed in Bloodline or was it revealed in Aftermath that she was Chancellor?
Here we are getting completely confused now. it could have been both. I mean, it is for sure that she was Chancellor.
Right. Well, I know Aftermath was published first. And then Bloodline was after The Force Awakens. So Aftermath might have gotten to it first. I don't know. The information is starting to kind of bleed, you know, because which makes sense. You know, they're building a massive universe, so kind of like once you know a fact, it's hard to remember which book you learned it from.
Yeah, especially only reading the book once.
Right. It's not like the movies where you can kind of close your eyes and play the whole thing in your head.
Exactly.
Yeah. But, yeah, no, I'm saying I like that we got, you know, mentions to Mon Mothma. We got a little Admiral Ackbar, Nienum, Snap Wexley at the end. Nice tie-in to Aftermath. And then again, you know, him in The Force Awakens. You know, they are really building, like, a lot of bridge characters, which I like. You know, and they have so much room to play with. It's a big sandbox.
Oh, for
this
sure.
Period, this 30-year period, you know?
You know, does the end of Bloodline, I remember finishing that, and then the same day, reading Poe Dameron 1. And if I'm not mistaken, I think 1, Bloodline kind of leads right into the beginning of Poe Dameron.
I have actually not started Poe Dameron yet. That's on my queue. I've got like 7 issues, 8 issues, whatever it is. I was going to binge read them. So I can't say yet, but I'll read it ASAP and I'll let you know.
Yeah, I remember reading one and then just by chance picking up Poe Dameron next and being like, oh my God, this just, it's seamless.
Okay. At least it felt that way. That's exciting. Yeah, you know what? I'll have to read the last page or listen to the last few minutes of Bloodline and then just pick up Poe Dameron and see what happens and see if I can imagine that seamless connection.
Yeah, and if it's not that, then maybe it's the Poe Dameron story. Actually, you know what? Scratch all that. Now it's starting to make more sense. I think the Poe Dameron... Have you read Before the Awakening?
No, I have all 3 of them. I haven't read them yet.
So Before the Awakening, the Poe Dameron story... That the mm-hmm. end of that story leads directly into the Poe Dameron comic.
Okay.
Now it's coming clear.
Okay, so I should give that a quick read before reading the comic?
I would say so. It's not necessary, but it's just kind of cool to see how these different media are connected and how they're paying attention to those details.
Yeah. Oh, that's awesome. I didn't realize that. That's so cool.
Yeah, so I think we kind of touched on the big plot points of Bloodline. You know, the most important being Leia's reputation as a trusted politician is completely ruined. So now we know why she's not connected at all politically in The Force Awakens. We know now that at least we suspect. She talks about sending that letter to Kylo Ren, but I think it's also mentioned that she doesn't know if or when he's seen that message.
Right. Well, he certainly knows in The Force Awakens, obviously, the way he...
Oh, yeah. No, he
looks up to Darth Vader. So it's interesting to know when that unveils, and I'm hoping... At some point, it'll probably be after episode 8, because I'm sure they're trying really hard to not spoil too much. You know, they're obviously being very careful with what information they reveal in novels and comics and whatnot. So, but I would like to see, at least maybe after episode 8, a story that does delve into, you know, I want to see Luke and Ben, in that training, you know, in this time period. But I'm pretty sure they're probably holding on to that for a while.
Yeah, I think so. But it does hint at some pretty big things, and at least gives us some backstory that will eventually make more sense. The context into Han and Leia's relationship, but it's clear that they still very much love each other, but they're mm-hmm. clearly on diverging paths despite their attempts to come together. Yeah, and you can still see how Leia depends on Luke, but she can't lean on him anymore because he's basically out of the picture and has faded from public life. And I think that was one of the big things that we learn about Leia, is that she's, in a way, even though she's surrounded by politicians and friends, she's really quite isolated. Like all of her closest allies, her husband, her brother, they're gone. Her son. And she's got really nobody to lean on but herself, which I think was it's a testament to the character of Leia that she stands in there again. And we talked about it in sort of our cathartic release on Princess Leia / Carrie Fisher, that she stood toe to toe with some real heavyweights on screen. And here she is in this book standing on her own again and holding her own with the whole Senate of the galaxy.
Yeah, for sure. Like we were saying, it is very tragic. But I don't know. Like you said, it is a testament to her character and that strength, and she really has been able to kind of hold her own after all these years. You know, fighting the rebellion, rebuilding the Senate. You know, she is badass, Leia. And you get that, and you know, despite kind of the personal stuff in her life at the moment, you know, she's able to really, like you said, hold her own. And I think it's, you know, it's one thing that really makes the character so inspirational. Kind of like harkening back to what we were saying before.
Yeah, they really push Leia, you know, emotionally and psychologically in this book. And there's moments where Claudia Gray hints that, you know, Leia's on the verge of breaking down into tears and just collapsing, but she always keeps it together and moves forward and puts forth the solution. So where do you slot this? I mean, you're getting into the new canon now. This was, I think it was a really good read, but in terms of importance, where does this book fall for you?
I mean, I feel like a lot of these novels, I feel like a lot of them are so different. You know, it's hard to, like with the movies, I would say rank them, but as far as level of importance, I mean, I feel like it adds a lot of weight to Leia's character. It adds a lot of weight to Hosni and Prime. So I think on the emotional side of things, you know, and it reveals a little bit of how the First Order got started. I don't know if it's need to know as far as being able to enjoy The Force Awakens, but I think it gives a lot of depth to where the galaxy is, where Princess Leia is, and just the state of the galaxy. You know, it's not as prequel necessary as, say, Catalyst was to Rogue One. I wouldn't say I was surprised at how much I enjoyed Catalyst. You know, I was surprised at how tied that book was to the movie. And that has certainly affected my viewing of Rogue One. But I wouldn't say that this changes my viewing of The Force. I wouldn't have enjoyed The Force Awakens more the first time around had I read this. But in retrospect, I could appreciate it more.
Yeah, it just gives us a home to certain story elements that, for people who haven't read Bloodline, are kind of twisting in the wind a little bit. Yeah, I think this is one of the key books so far of the new canon. I'll have to think a little bit more about where I'd rank it officially, but I would say for anybody who is thinking about reading the new canon, but only has limited time or resources, that this would be one that would be on the short list of books to read.
I would say top three, probably, of the importance so far. I mean, we know that they got many more coming down the pipe.
Oh, geez. Yeah, that is for sure. We've got Empire's End coming, the end of the Aftermath trilogy. The Thrawn book is coming, and that's you know, that's February and April, respectively.
It's a little side note from Bloodline. It's interesting that you bring up the Thrawn novel. Do you feel, at least as far as Aftermath is concerned, that, I mean, I'm not that far into Life Debt at the moment, but are they trying to almost, it almost feels like they're making the Aftermath trilogy almost a bit like the Thrawn trilogy. I never read the Thrawn trilogy, but in the sense that it's a trilogy that takes place right after Return of the Jedi, and you have Grand Admiral Sloane. You know, do you feel like they're trying to parallel that? And I'm wondering, you know, what they're going to do with Thrawn. Now, I mean, we'll see where his character goes in Rebels, but do we know when the Thrawn novel takes place?
At least I don't. And I don't think there's been an official synopsis revealed for it yet.
Yeah. I kind of lost my main point there, but I guess they're trying to parallel the original expanded universe a little bit.
or at least wallpaper over it as quickly as they can.
Yeah.
Erase it from existence. One or the other.
I guess we'll see where Empire's End, because I haven't really finished Life Debt yet, but I could imagine, since that's going to end with the Battle of Jakku, that that final novel will probably rank the, you know, we'd have to see with how the entire series, we couldn't just look at it as one book, you know what I mean?
We'd have
to see how it affects as like one full story.
Yeah, for sure. One really long story. Steve, thank you, sir, for jumping in again this week.
Of course. Happy to do it.
I wish some of it was under happier circumstances, but
yeah.
Unfortunately, I think, you know, as time moves in one direction, this is something that we're going to have to get used to. And we've kind of gotten accustomed to blaming 2016 for these sorts of things. But it's not 2016's fault. It's just the inevitability of death. And we're going to be dealing with this again in the future and maybe sooner than we like. So,
I mean, I think it's just important to know, you know, just as fans, you know, we have all these wonderful memories of Carrie Fisher. She's given us such wonderful treasures. I think it's just important to just, you know, be happy that we have all of this that we can share. And, you know, it's important just to remember, you know, the good things going forward.
Well, yeah, and that's it. I mean, the reason why we're hurt so much by this loss is because of all the good that she gave us.
Yeah.
I mean, if she was just a passing character in the night that you know, had three forgettable lines, well, we'd pay our respects and in 30 seconds we'd move on. But no, she's on the Mount Rushmore of Star Wars characters, and it's impossible to overstate what she means to this franchise and to this fan base. So, my thanks to her for sure. And again, my sympathies to her family and, to Star Wars fans everywhere. I guess we got to do these things. We got to talk ourselves through this and share stories of Carrie, of Princess Leia, and get through this in any way we can. So anyway, that was our tribute episode to Carrie Fisher, to Princess Leia, our beloved princess in general. And my thanks to Steve. Steve, we can find you on Twitter at
JoangoFett.
Excellent. And my thanks to James for jumping in. Find James at TommyBombadil1. And don't forget about our friends at the Star Wars Commonwealth. Check out Talk Star Wars, Generation X-Wing, the Skyhoppers, Rogue Squadron Podcast, and the Nerd Room. And that'll be it for now. That's it for Journals of the Willing, number 2. And we'll be back again in a couple weeks. And until then, you'll catch us on the Tumbling Saber Podcast. And we will see you soon.
You've been listening to Journals of the Willing from the Tumbling Saber team, a member of the Star Wars Commonwealth Podcast Network. Learn more about the network and its members at starwarscommonwealth.com.